Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
There is no question, everywhere I go in the four or five states I've been to so far, we've had a lot of producers into the USDA headquarters. When I'm in Washington, I'm sort of constantly trying to be talking to them and hearing their concerns directly. It's very helpful for me personally and figuring out what the next steps are.
New Secretary of Ag, Brooke Rollins.
Everyone is very concerned. And so ensuring that we have all of the data, the information that we need, understanding the decisions that they're being made, that are being currently made, what implications those have. Obviously, that is my role, to take that to President Trump and to the team that is negotiating, that is working on those deals, to ensure that those concerns are heard effectively and that we have a plan in place to make sure that our farm community is not compromised more. Thank you.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Free trade, fair trade, neither? Well, that's the argument being made right now as President Donald Trump has initiated tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China. China hit back hard on Tuesday, saying it will impose additional tariffs of up to 15% on some U.S. goods from March 10th and restrict exports to 15 U.S. companies. Retaliatory measures coming from China's Ministry of Finance and Ministry of Commerce came just as additional U.S. tariffs took effect on Chinese goods. What are they specifically? Well, the Chinese government says that the tariffs will be imposed on some imported goods originating in the U.S. beginning March the 10th. An imposition of 15% tariffs on chicken, wheat, corn, and cotton. And second, the sorghum, soybeans, pork, beef, aquatic products, fruits, vegetables, dairy products, and that is a 10% tariff on those.
I will immediately begin the overhaul of our trade system to protect American workers and families. Instead of taxing our citizens to enrich other countries, we will tariff and tax foreign countries to enrich our citizens. For this purpose, we are establishing the External Revenue Service to collect all tariffs, duties, and revenues. It will be massive amounts of money pouring into our treasury coming from foreign sources.
Earlier this year, President Donald Trump. Now, Ron Wyden is a Democrat from Oregon and a member of the Senate Finance Committee.
The centerpiece of the Trump economic agenda is extending his 2017 tax law at a cost of more than $4 trillion. Ultra-wealthy individuals who rake in millions each year would get tax breaks of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Families who live paycheck to paycheck would be lucky if they could just get enough to cover the grocery bill for a week. How does Donald Trump and Republicans plan to pay for their multi-trillion dollar giveaways to the ultra-wealthy? For starters, they'll be offering across-the-board tariffs. And let's be clear about what that's all about. Trillions of dollars in new taxes paid for by working Americans and small businesses. And to me, the ultimate distillation of the Trump agenda is paying for tax breaks for the top by increasing child hunger, booting tens of millions off their health insurance, and laying off hundreds of thousands of manufacturing workers. It feels to me like a class war on typical American families.
The average effective U.S. tariff rate on Chinese goods, 33%, up from around 13% before Trump began his latest term in January, and U.S. ag products account for the largest share of U.S. goods exported to China. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So what happens if we can clean up ourselves? What happens if we're able to squeeze waste and fraud and find more modern ways that are more compassionate, more efficient to actually deliver the benefits to our brothers and sisters?
Arizona Representative David Schweikert is the chairman of the U.S. Joint Economic Committee for the 119th Congress.
We're actually seeing numbers. It could be, just thought experiment. We've been working on lists after lists after lists after lists of things you could modernize, reduce spending, and never cut someone's benefits, never cut their services. We have one project we're doing in our office. How many in Medicare and Medicaid and Indian Health Services and DOD and VA, how many duplicative scans are there? I mean, how many people go get an MRI, an X-ray, an ultrasound, and do you take that and then immediately attach it to someone's phone so the scan is mobile with them? We're seeing numbers where it's billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars being spent in duplicative scans. Is that cutting someone's service? Of course it isn't. Now, the lobbyists get upset because they make money on how many times, or at least their clients do. But this is, I need you to think about how you modernize to do it better, faster, and cheaper, and more compassionate. We've done entire presentations here on the floor over the years trying to demonstrate that maybe the most moral thing we could do as a government is actually help people to be healthier. If we're seeing data that says 5% of the population with multiple chronic conditions are over half of all healthcare spend, what would happen if we actually focused on helping them be cured? If diabetes is 33% of all U.S. healthcare spending, should we actually think about that? If it's over $600 billion, 16% of U.S. healthcare by people crashing, having a stroke because they didn't take their calcium inhibitors, or things of that nature, are the things we can do to help our brothers and sisters be healthier. And it turns out, a year ago, the Joint Economic Economists actually did a study that obesity in America maybe an additional $9.1 trillion in healthcare over the next 10 years. Turns out that becomes the number one spend in the U.S. government. How do we make our brothers and sisters healthier so they can participate in the economy? Maybe they can actually have families. Maybe they and there's suddenly this awakening in America, and it's that Republican or Democrat. I would argue it's just moral. We want our brothers and sisters to not only live longer but more vibrantly. So are we willing to do very difficult things in farm policy and nutrition policy and how we deliver health services? It's worth thinking about, but as being in this stupid town, instantly the partisan rage is, oh, how's that going to get me elected? How am I going to use it as a wedge to beat the crap out of the other side? Maybe the morality of helping our brothers and sisters and not having this country be crushed in debt when the bond market is the most influential group in America today. Not members of Congress.
Arizona Republican Representative David Schweikert. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Upfront reminder here is I track meat demand in lots of different ways, and we use USDA's, at least historically available, lag data. And I'm saying lag because it comes out about 6 weeks after the time period we're talking about. And I most recently made those updates again on February 19th. And the data that's freshest in that exercise is for December.
Kansas State livestock marketing economist Dr. Glenn Tonser.
December of 2024, domestic meat demand was up for beef compared to December of 23, not quite 4%. I made the comment you look month to month, 10 of the 12 months during 2024. I would say per this measure, domestic beef demand was up. That's great for the beef sector. I'll pause and interject there. It's more than supply. It's supply and demand. When you have demand increasing and supplies were, you know, they turned out a little bit up, but we were actually expecting them to be down. And we're pretty confident they're going to be down here in 25. That demand pull was key to those higher prices in 2024 that most cattlemen experienced. Domestic pork demand was down 3% in December of 24. And 2024 was a mixed bag for pork demand. So 6 of the 12 months were positive, which means 6 of the 12 were negative. And then chicken demand was actually very strong in December, up 11%. 8 of the 12 months of 2024, domestic chicken demand increased. So overall, good story. Pork is a little bit more mixed than beef and chicken in 2024. Rounded out, I also do the same thing for export demand. So Mexico, Canada, you know, Japan, foreign consumers buying U.S. meat. December 24, foreign demand for beef was up 5%. Pork was up 1.5%. Chicken down 23%, a big pullback there. I won't bring down every month-by-month number, but I'll just highlight all 12 months in 2024, foreign demand for U.S. beef was higher. So not only was domestic demand up in 10 of the 12, foreign demand was up in all 12. So combined those two, demand for U.S. beef was quite strong in 2024. Again, that underpinned those elevated cattle prices in 2024 and is why I'm concerned a little bit about the macro developments I alluded to, macroeconomic developments, because demand is core.
From meat demand to egg prices, any correlation?
So egg prices are definitely elevated, right? I don't want to ignore that. There's been lots of attention. You know, I've engaged the media on it different ways, and I don't want to dismiss they're elevated. What's probably most relevant for our listeners here today, because we often talk beef cattle markets in these segments, is I think the egg situation probably is and definitely has the risk of spilling over into a broader food price discussion. For some context, the percentage of our budget that's spent on food is really good around the world, and the percentage of your budget spent on eggs is a very small set of that for food, right? So I'm reminded of this, is I want to be sensitive to it, but I think we overstate the direct impact of an egg price on consumers' budgets and so forth. But what's very relevant is if it impacts their sentiment. So if given the narrative about higher egg prices makes one concern that everything might be going up, and for various reasons, there's renewed discussions about inflation, again, whether or not we're having a second dip of that by historical standards, I'm interjecting that kind of pause is the relevance for eggs is indirect for the meat and livestock industry. It's a little more direct in the broiler space because discussions about vaccines and so forth, but more broad from the meat world. If consumers get more pessimistic, if they start tightening their wallet and they're less willing to spend, that becomes sort of a self-induced recession is the concern, right? So I purposely highlight, and I often do, the role of meat demand for cattle, livestock producers more generally. In 2024, on balance, was very good. There's a real risk that the egg narrative turns into a adverse sentiment situation for consumers that becomes a headwind as 2025 develops. I hope that entire situation improves for several reasons, but specific to the beef, pork, chicken arena here we're talking about, I think that indirect impact via consumer sentiment is really important to monitor.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Cotton can be the choice. And the whole idea here is that the companies that we work with at Cotton Incorporated, the many retailers, brands, manufacturers around the world, they have a choice. And simply because we grow cotton in the United States doesn't mean that people are going to use cotton.
Mark Misura with Cotton Incorporated.
And one of the things that we're faced with in the Cotton Research and Promotion Program is how to market cotton, how to call out different aspects of cotton so that cotton can be the choice, the ingredient, rather than many other types of fibers that are available. So we have to work for cotton to be that choice. So if you're a clothing designer, you're asking yourself this question, which fiber should I use? Polyester, nylon, lyocell, acetate, cotton? What should I put in this product? And really, when we work with companies, there are three reasons, primary reasons, why people make the decision to use cotton or not use cotton. And these reasons are form the vertices of this triangle, and we call this the marketing triangle. And essentially what this means is when you look at anything, whether that's shirts or jeans or slacks or dresses, a designer will ask, well, what's the marketing advantage? Is it because it's natural, or maybe there's a strong consumer preference, or there's some other type of marketing benefit? What are the economics around the fiber? What does it cost to use this fiber? What does it cost to buy the raw material? How are those costs expressed in manufacturing? Does it cost more or less than other types of fibers and ingredients? And a third part of this triangle is technology and performance. Can you do something differently with this fiber? If we use cotton, can we do something different? Or is there a technological advantage to using polyester or nylon or something else? So this is the basic marketing triangle that exists. This is the fiber choice. And increasingly, especially over the last 10 years, more and more retailers and brands are saying, well, the marketing triangle is great. We're going to think about marketing and economics and technology. But in order for your fiber to be eligible to get in the triangle, we need to see some other information. You've got to establish confidence in your fiber as it relates to sustainability, circularity, recycling, biodegradability, these kinds of issues. And increasingly, companies are saying, how does your fiber, how does cotton stack up against other fibers when it comes to important aspects like sustainability? And if you can convince us that we can be confident with cotton, then we'll go and evaluate whether it makes economic, marketing, or technological sense to use cotton.
Is there more that can be done?
What are the other things we can do as a company and as a program to support the use of cotton and to push it and advance it, even when cotton might be at an economic disadvantage relative to polyester and nylon and other synthetic fibers? There are really four types of marketing that we want to talk to you about this morning. The way that we can inspire cotton use, ways that we can secure cotton use in products, things that we can do that are supporting the use of cotton among many companies. And then increasingly, a lot of our effort is in promoting compliance to make sure cotton is compliant with the requirements that brands, retailers, and the industry are setting for fibers.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The planted area, 6 million acres, down 300,000 from last year. Yields back up to kind of a normal mode of 68.8 bushels an acre. A little higher production. Really, if there's a big change, is that they're de-emphasizing, consistent with what's happening now, de-emphasizing exports.
Dan O'Brien is a grain economist at Kansas State University.
This year, right now, they're projecting 170 million. They took the projection for next year down to 125 and then added that reduction back to food, seed, and industrial use, i.e. ethanol, and feed residual up about 35. So that type of shifting around, ending stocks a little bit higher at 40 million bushels, stocks to use up to 11.4%. The price down to $4 from $4.25.
Director of the IGP Institute, Dr. Guy Allen.
Looking at those historical spreads, and it's reflected in price, we see you sort of go to a pretty good discount with pretty cheap basis relative to corn, particularly across Kansas. And that's with that absence of the Chinese market there. There's been some sales on, but we haven't had any new sales, and those sales seem to have been pushed back and delayed, and that's really weighing on this sorghum price. We go back 3 years, 23, 24, sorghum USDA average, season average price was a 38-cent premium to corn. Last year, it was at a 10-cent discount, and for this coming year, it's projected to be a 20-cent discount, and I wouldn't be surprised to see that quite even cheaper. And what we're doing is, without that Chinese export market there, sorghum's pricing itself into the feed rations and into the ethanol consumption there, and we're seeing that in the numbers.
What else was a hot topic at the recent USDA Ag Outlook Forum?
Big emphasis on meat production, domestic feed usage being more the future than shipping grain overseas. So that was thought provoking. A guy, I heard one comment that Dow made in particular, that we could do a number of small trade deals all over the world, but it'd be hard pressed to have to make up the difference in lower Chinese exports. So that was pretty telling to me.
On the topic of trade, Allen explains.
China continues to improve its production practices across the board, not only in its row crops like corn and wheat, but also in its livestock area, particularly on pork, poultry, and dairy production. I would add into that protein complex of exports to China in their milk and dairy as well. China's a pretty big importer of dairy along with the beef. And while I think growth into China has stalled, you know, they're still going to be a significant buyer of U.S. products potentially. But that shift in production capacity and performance is we're going to feel that in agriculture. That said, look, Mexico is our biggest corn buyer with the Canadians in there as well as Japan. They've come on strong this year. Looking at the other comments that I sort of noted down is, look, India is going to be, I think, the opportunity is they're the largest populous country out there. India is a hard nut to crack when it comes to trade. They use their import-export tariffs to manage their domestic price and supply. And that comes back, I think that was Greg Dowd that said, you know, it's what we're going to have is a bunch of small advancements and wins in the trade area. You know, the easy lifting has been done, you know, thanks to Greg's efforts and Lighthizer there as well. And it's going to be a lot more challenge. And in this new environment, it's going to be a bit more strategic on that. So it's not going to be easy to grow that. Look, the world's still hungry for food and particularly protein.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The ability of our family pig farmers to continue farming in Minnesota is a frequent topic of discussion amongst our members.
Daryl Timmerman is past president, Minnesota Pork Producers.
Through voluntary efforts, Minnesota pig farmers are working to ensure and working to measure, quantify, and report on our work to operate our businesses in a sustainable way. We've set goals that reflect the industry's widely adopted We Care ethical principles, including animal health, public health, food safety, our communities, our people, and the environment. We continue to grow the participation in our We Care sustainability reports that help measure our progress over time against our goals for things like increasing carbon sequestration and reducing water use.
But says they need some legislative changes.
We've heard from our farmer members about Minnesota's increasingly burdensome tax environment, costly and lengthy permitting process, and expensive and tight labor markets, putting additional stress on farmers and their businesses. As a mature industry, the ability to permit, remodel, and invest in our barns will become increasingly important. Aging barns require maintenance and replacement, and without a transparent, predictable, and financially reasonable permitting process, we will see farmers who choose to exit the business because the barriers become too significant to overcome. Similarly, state rules and regulations not based on science will put undue pressure on farmers looking to invest in their farms in Minnesota. As Minnesotans, we all care for our shared natural resources. We believe farms can grow and prosper in Minnesota while protecting our land, air, and water. Minnesota's income, business, and estate tax codes create disincentives for farmers. Farming is extremely capital intensive. Much of farmers' investment is in land, animals, and equipment, with many farmers investing profits back into the business or simply trying to pay down debt. Ensuring that farming businesses can transition between generations without significant cost or taxes will be key to future success in Minnesota. Additionally, the tight labor market and increasing costs to comply with Minnesota's new labor mandates further erode farmers' competitiveness with our neighbors in neighboring states. Minnesota farmers have taken great strides to adopt technology where possible, but at the end of the day, caring for pigs requires hands-on, skilled workforce. Minnesota's farms vary in size from sole proprietors to large enterprises with many employees. These sweeping mandates add significant costs and weigh heavily on farmers' decisions. Profitability matters, and sometimes it feels like that's forgotten or looked down upon. But it's what makes investing in our people, in our communities, possible.
Statewide investments have been helpful.
We're appreciative of many initiatives at the state legislature that support Minnesota's livestock and broader agricultural industry investment programs, like the Center for Rural Behavioral Health and the Livestock Investment Grant Program. Soil Health Financial Assistance Grant and the Rural Financial Authority help support the next generation of agriculturalists and the health of our rural community and workforce. Investments in support of the Board of Animal Health, the University of Minnesota's Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, and the Office of Preparedness and Response at the Department of Agriculture are all critically needed as we work to prevent and prepare for animal disease outbreaks. As a swine industry, we've invested significantly in activities, plans, and exercises to ensure we can respond swiftly to an outbreak in our swine herd. So in closing, our industry has certainly had some headwinds. There's some opportunity on the horizon. But at the end of the day, we're confident that Minnesota's pig farmers will continue to have the opportunity to thrive here in the state of Minnesota. This help will be brought forth with streamlined areas around permitting, as well as the continued support of our Board of Animal Health to ensure that our health of our animals can continue to have the resources necessary.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Competitiveness in global markets, ag trade concerns, tight farm and food producer margins, some of the challenges and risk in the ag sector in 2025. What are some of those concerns expressed by farmers to Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City President and CEO Jeff Schmid?
Some of them are offsetting, but the nature of risks are you need positive margins in the agricultural business for our economy to grow.
Speaking at this year's USDA Ag Outlook Forum, Schmid explains factors such as ag sectors where margins are tighter than others, grains versus livestock, for instance, as well as equity building around lamb prices, are all part of the discussion of risk, forwarding that nationwide, involving all 12 Federal Reserve Banks and the Federal Open Market Committee.
What we try to do is bring to the FOMC what influences the traditional farmer and agricultural operations are bringing to that data, and then try to bridge it to other types of agriculture.
I'm Rod Bain, reporting in Washington, D.C.